Call is now being recorded.
I think that I can just briefly, I think I said in the email, but just again, you know, this is through Harvard's National Preparedness Leadership Institute, where we're doing a project specifically looking at public health preparedness messaging and how to most effectively provide messages to the public in advance of an emergency, but also thinking about at the time. And the product that we're working towards is some guidance that we could share with public health preparedness directors around how to best allocate resources around this issue. And so obviously you're really an expert in risk communication and have done a lot of work on emergency issues. And so we really appreciate being able to speak with you.
I'm delighted to do it.
Thank you. So I guess the first question is, what has been your experience in regards to state and local public health emergency preparedness campaigns and sort of your thoughts on the preparedness side of getting messages out in advance in an effective way?
Well, I think we have to start by making a distinction. I mean, you made the distinction, which is a good one, between talking about preparedness on the one hand and after the emergency materializes, talking to people to guide them through the crisis. And
right.
That's an important distinction. But there's another one within preparedness. I think there's a real difference between trying to urge people to take precautions and trying to urge people to be okay with you taking precaution. And obviously, state and local agencies have a need to do both. On the one hand, they're saying, you know, pack your go kit for a possible pandemic, or, be prepared to evacuate if there's a flood and things like that. But they're also saying, you know, support us in wanting to spend tax money on this and that and the other precaution for our city or for our state or for our country. They're both worth talking about. Where do you want us to start?
Wherever you think, we'll sort of let you take the lead.
Let me say just a little bit about the smaller, or at least the issue I have less to say about, which is societal emergency preparedness. I think that's much harder to do than people imagine. I think it's a particularly tough sell to try to persuade publics that they should let you spend money preparing for a possible emergency that hasn't happened yet. And there are a number of reasons why. I mean, the most obvious reason is people feel like we already have problems. You know, I mean, you're taking a dollar directly from schools and welfare and actual health care and problems we know we face in order to prepare for a problem that we may or may not face. So I think, in times of tough budgets, people are just, very inclined to say, I don't want a lot of money on preparedness when we've got real problems under budgeted. Beyond that, I think there's an implied criticism in saying we want to spend money on preparedness. It often implies to people that they or the society at large have made bad decisions. Now we have to prepare for these emergencies because we didn't make the right decisions. A third issue, and it's connected to the second, is insofar as people want money spent on emergencies that haven't happened yet, they're much happier spending money on prevention than they are on preparedness. When you say you're talking about preparedness, I don't know if you mean the term literally or if you're including prevention. But there's a real distinction between doing things so that something won't happen versus doing things so that if it happens, we'll be better able to cope with it. There's actually three levels. You can prevent it entirely. You can mitigate it, that is, make it less likely or less awful, or you can prepare to cope with it. And that's the order of people's preference. There's research that people will spend a great deal more money to take a problem off the table than to make it smaller. But they'll spend more money to make it smaller than to be better able to deal with it without making it smaller. So preparedness is the least attractive of the three and intuitively to people. And that's a big issue. And then the fourth reason why it's hard, I think I'm counting right, is that people don't want to be scared. They would rather think bad things can't happen, or think we're sufficiently prepared already. And there's the normal resistance to any message that says, add this to your worry agenda, as if you didn't have enough to worry about already. Now, I think there are ways of coping with all those barriers, but they all start with realizing that it's a tough sell. When you go to a populace and you say, we want to spend tax money getting ready for a pandemic that might or might not happen, or getting ready for an earthquake, or getting ready for a flood, we're not going to make them less likely. We're not going to make them smaller. We're going to make ourselves better able to cope with them if they happen. You're flying in the face of all four of those objections.
Right. I just want to say this really resonates because not necessarily related to this project, but a priority for us at the health department right now, we're getting huge cuts in our preparedness funding, specifically right now with our healthcare preparedness funding of 30% cut. So we're really looking at how we can get out there and tell our story about how this money is being used and really advocate for this funding. So we're really struggling with sort of what that story looks like and how do we make it compelling. And while we're talking about sort of congressional types, they are people. How do we make this compelling to people overall?
Well, I mean, there's a window of opportunity after something bad has happened. The life history of any crisis is before the crisis, you're doing precaution advocacy, urging people to take it seriously. During the crisis, you're doing crisis communication, helping people cope with it. After the crisis, you're doing outrage management, addressing people's anger or recriminations that you let it happen and you weren't as prepared as you ought to have been. During that post-crisis period, when people are unhappy with how well the crisis got managed and unhappy that it happened at all, there is a brief window of opportunity to talk about preparedness and to get people to say, yes, we want you to spend money on preparedness. As I expect, during that window, people tend to want to spend too much on preparedness. They want to prepare for what just happened, often excessively. After a record snowfall, it's easy to get people enthusiastic about buying, plows that you won't need until the next record snowfall. It's sort of strike while the iron is hot, and right in the immediate post-emergency period is probably the best time to argue on behalf of preparedness for the next emergency.
And how long does that window last, typically, would you say?
Oh, I don't know. I'd hesitate to quantify it. It'll last longer if you seize it. That is, when
right.
you talk, you keep the window open for a while. I think it closes within weeks or at most months if it's not used. But if it is used, then the issue gets on the people's agenda, and you can prolong, I think, their interest in preparedness by seizing the moment when they are naturally interested because they just dealt with it. I've worked in Australia on bushfires, and certainly the best time to get people to want to do bushfire preparedness is when there is one elsewhere or has recently been one right here. It's most easy to imagine, in the wake of one here or in the midst of one elsewhere, so that'd be another, in addition to post-crisis, when the emergency is happening elsewhere, it's a good time to say to people where you are, that could happen to us too. Why don't we spend some money being better able to prepare? prepare, you know, better able to cope with it, maybe better able to prevent it as well. I think, you know, since people care more about prevention than they do about preparedness and coping, sometimes you can, I think, legitimately frame an expenditure either way, and it's worth knowing that you're better off framing it as prevention. So let's say you're thinking about doing a building a storm sewer. On the one hand, you know, you could say, you know, that storm sewer is going to be useful to help us cope with flooding. If there's flooding upstream, it will help us deal with the flooding. But you could just as accurately say it'll help us prevent flooding the neighborhood. So you're coping with the flood upstream. You're preventing the flood in the neighborhood. The latter is going to get you a much more support than the former. And they're both accurate.
And I think there's also opportunity to stress the mitigation more than the third one. Because I think a lot of the work we do is to mitigate it and make it less awful, but we tend to stress the three.
Yes, I think that's right. I think you know, mitigation isn't as good as prevention, but it's a lot more attractive than preparedness. And you can, you know, if what you're doing is in large measure mitigation, you certainly shouldn't neglect to say so.
Right. Okay, well, that's very helpful. In terms of you saying, you know, strike when the iron is hot, you have this window of opportunity, you know, you specifically talked about resources, but also in terms of potentially actions that people could take to better prepare should something happen, do you have thoughts on sort of what are effective messages that you could deliver at that time that might be, you know, scenario specific or sort of more all hazards broad?
So you're segueing from spending tax money to prepare the society to urging people to,
yes,
to spend their own time and money to prepare themselves.
Yes.
And I think in both cases, all hazards measures are easier to sell than hazard specific measures. But I think most of the time you don't have to choose. You know, I mean, it's fairly easy to make both arguments simultaneously, and you know, to say, you know, we want to do this because we're worried about pandemics, but it'll also help in a flood or a hurricane. You know, I mean, insofar as that's true, and it's often true, I would make the hazard specific reference to the hazard that's most on your mind and most on your audience's mind, and I would make the all hazards argument.
Right.
That said, I mean, the single most important thing I would want to say about how to get people to take precautions is don't expect miracles. The rule of thumb is it takes a generation to get people to take a new risk seriously and or to adopt a new precaution. It took a generation to get seatbelts, you know, popular. It took a generation to get smoke alarms popular. Hard hats took two generations. There's a lot of resistance among construction workers and others in dangerous occupations about wearing hard hats and other personal protective equipment. Vaccinations took at least a generation. Many vaccinations took several. So the idea that, you know, you can you know, start at ground zero and get people to take the risk seriously and take the precautions on board within a year or two, I think it's just expecting too much of ourselves. It's a slog, and it's a competition. And there aren't a lot of people with too little to worry about who are sort of sitting around thinking, "Gee, I wish I had more problems. My worry agenda isn't full." That's a very uncommon state of mind. Most people have more problems than they have time and energy and you know, willingness to think about. So they're doing triage at all times. And, you know, I think it's very useful for people to bear in mind that if you're trying to get people more worried about X so that they're likelier to take precautions, by definition, you're going to have to get them less worried about Y. And you don't know what why is, and you don't particularly get to pick why. I mean, sometimes you can say worry about my ex instead of their why. But you're not going to get people to be more worried across the board, to have a bigger niche for risk management in their lives than they already have. That's very, very hard to do. I mean, people have as much of that as they have. They may differ from their neighbor, but they don't differ from the way they were last week. So it's a competition, which I think sometimes my clients find very reassuring. A lot of my public health and government clients are sort of reluctant to scare people. And it's kind of, it helps. It's reassuring to realize you're not going to make them more frightened people. You're going to take the amount of fearfulness they already have and try and compete better for a bigger slice of it. So you're competing for your slice of the fearfulness pie. You're not making people more fearful. I think that sort of legitimates doing it, you know, being willing to reach out to people. Implicit in what I'm saying is that the single best way, it's not the only way, but the single best way to get people to take precautions is to get them to be more worried about the risk. And, you know, I use fear and fearfulness a lot. Clients who find fear terrifying, you know, I'll back into worry. And if they find worry worrisome, I'll back into concern, which is, you know, the wimpy cousin of fear and worry. But some kind of emotional, personal commitment to this risk being, you know, worth my time, worth my energy, worth, you know, making room for on my worry agenda, that's the key. It's not about data. It's not about facts. It really is about getting people more upset. I think a lot of people have read somewhere along the line that fear appeals can backfire. And that's true at the extremes. You know, it's true that if people get too frightened, they can go into some kind of paralysis. Panic is very rare, as I expect you know, but denial isn't so rare, and paralysis isn't so rare. And if you get people too frightened, you know, I mean, you know, the relationship between fear and precaution taking is a U curve. You know, the at low levels, the more fear, the better. At high levels, too much fear can backfire. But we almost never get to high levels. It's a real problem, but it's not a very common problem in public affairs. It's much more a real problem in individual relations. If you're a doctor talking to your cancer patient, too much fear is real. If you're a public health agency talking to the general public via the media, too much fear is pretty unlikely, and too little fear is the issue you face every day. So in general, you know, getting people more frightened, more worried, more concerned gets them more willing to take precautions and also more willing to let you take precautions. So it's useful, you know, bordering on essential, both in getting people to act on an individual level and in getting them supportive of community action.
Got it. I mean, I will say sort of through our research, it seems like it's just very – we're finding that a lot of preparedness campaigns have really not been successful, and we're – and certainly there's a complete lack of evaluation data, but there is – we're sort of amazed at how many resources continue to still go into these large-scale preparedness campaigns and – you know, specifically thinking about some of them generated by the federal government. And one of the concerns that has been raised is sort of there's an attractiveness to still doing these campaigns on the part of government and feeling like, you know, part of it is justifying their existence in non-emergency times. And I think there is still a belief that maybe these do make a difference. Do you have any thoughts on sort of how to address that, and, you know, because we're talking about shrinking resources, and if it's very difficult to have these general preparedness campaigns make an impact, maybe this is not the best source of best allocation of funding.
Well, I think for sure, you know, to do a campaign because you did one last year, you did one the year before, and that's what you do every March, is pretty unjustified. That every campaign ought to be evaluated, and the evaluation ought to be in terms of outcomes you care about, like people actually taking precautions, not just knowing you did a campaign. And, you know, campaigns that you can't find a way to make impactful, you know, you ought to spend the money someplace else. So, I mean, I absolutely agree that it shouldn't be masturbatory. It should, you know, it shouldn't be something you do for its own reward. You know, and you can't just count clips. You have to measure real impact. That said, you know, I'm not skeptical about the possibility of designing campaigns that work. You know, campaigns that attract a lot of interest, which requires that they be somewhat novel. I think about the CDC's preparedness campaign that made use of vampires. You're familiar with that one?
Yep.
You're talking about
the zombies, right?
The zombies, that's right.
Yep.
That zombie preparedness. And, you know, I haven't seen any evaluation. I've seen data on how many people, you know, wanted to look at it. I mean, they crashed the website, which is certainly a good sign. They attracted a lot of interest. But I'd be willing to bet, there ought to be data. There probably is data. But I'd be willing to bet that they made real progress, that significant numbers of people, not only found that interesting, but found it influential and went and packed a GoKid or, you know, took some of the other steps they were recommending. And it was very inexpensive. It's really sad that some of the higher ups at CDC found it insufficiently, professional in their fairly narrow judgment of what's professional. I gather the people who did the zombie campaign got a mix of great praise from the general public and from media people and from communication professionals, and internal criticism because they, you know, they were letting their hair down in ways that not everyone at CDC felt was appropriate. But, you know, I mean, that's a campaign that I'd be willing to bet earned its keep. And it is certainly possible to win in this competition for people's fearfulness. And, you know, I mean, you know, if, you know, the right wing is out there trying to make people afraid of gay marriage, and the Cancer Society is out there trying to make people afraid of cancer, and, you know, the environmentalists are out there trying to get people afraid of greenhouse gases, join the game, you know, but do it strategically. Figure out what's likeliest to do the job.
Right. And I'm
sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, the other thing is sort of through our reading and research is also just really focusing on simple messages that are digestible and that are action oriented. I mean, that's the other thing we're sort of taking away from it.
Absolutely action oriented. I have mixed feelings about simple and digestible. The more interesting something is, the less simple it has to be. And, you know, simple is a way of maybe getting through even if you're not very interesting because, you know, people will listen for 5 or 10 seconds, even if it's not interesting before they get around to changing channels or turning the page or just thinking about something else. So, I mean, it's certainly sound strategy to keep your messages as simple as you can, but in my judgment, not at the expense of making them interesting. I think attracting an audience and holding an audience by making them want to read what you wrote or watch what you're broadcasting, is more important than keeping it so simple that it's over before they get around to changing the channel.
And when you say more interesting, I know you've mentioned the zombie campaign as a model. I assume it's sort of the typical advertising industry of sort of how do you catch people's attention and how do you make something compelling? Is it applying sort of those same strategies to this content?
Yeah, I mean, we have an advantage over a lot of advertisers because we think what we're selling is more valuable. The problem for most product advertising, or at least for a lot of product advertising, is what they're selling isn't all that valuable, so they have to sell the sizzle, not the steak, because there's not much steak. There's not much value there. So, you know, they appeal to needs, they appeal to emotions, because that's all they've got. After they've caught your attention with emotion, I'll use an ad that's long gone because it was actually studied. You know, you look at toothpaste ads that relied on sex appeal, for example, or cigarette ads that relied on sex appeal. And, those ads worked, but they aroused cognitive dissonance. People would watch the ad and at some level of consciousness, they'd be thinking, gee, maybe if I use this brand of toothpaste, you know, I'll be sexually more successful. Or maybe if I smoke this brand of cigarettes, I'll be sexually more successful. But it wasn't really credible. And the only way the advertiser could hang on in the face of people thinking, I don't really believe that, that's kind of nutty, was to keep repeating the message again and again and again. We have a real advantage because we have messages, I think health messages and emergency preparedness messages are intrinsically sounder than smoke Newports in order to get lucky on Saturday night. But you still need to attract attention, so you still need, you have a better message, so you'll be less reliant on repetition, but you still need to get that initial attention and ideally an initial behavior. I spent a lot of time proposing to clients, not always successfully, because this sounds excessively manipulative to a lot of clients. But what I've said to clients is persuasion, if you have a good case, is a two-step process. In step one, you offer people a not very sound reason for doing what you want them to do. Do it because some movie star does it. Do it because this is a seductive message that appeals to needs and appeals to emotions. And if you can get people to expand their behavioral repertoire, to do something, just a foot in the door. It may not be the permanent behavior you're looking for, but to actually do something different, grounded in emotions and needs, then the result of having done something they haven't gotten any rational reason to want to do is cognitive dissonance. Now, that dissonance will motivate them to stop. But before it motivates them to stop, it motivates them to start looking for reasons to keep going. I'm summarizing a lot of theory very quickly. Does this make sense to you?
Yes, it does.
If in step one you get people based on a need or an emotion to actually make a behavioral commitment, then in step two, instead of all your information being boring and challenging to their current behavior, now it's supportive. All that information is evidence that they did the right thing, and that they should keep doing it, and that they should generalize it to other behaviors grounded in the same values. I think emergency preparedness communication and health communication are like advertising in step one. But for a lot of advertising, step two is step one, is do step one again, because you haven't got much of a rationale. Whereas, for us, step two can be a lot of information that keep going.
And do you have suggestions, because this is not our area of expertise, for step one in terms of applying it to public health and emergency preparedness? Do you have thoughts in this arena of how to appeal to people's needs or emotions?
Well, I mean, the most obvious emotion is fear. But there are certainly other emotions that you can appeal to. I think, you know, the people's desire to do the right thing is a powerful desire. And if you can suggest that this is what good people do, and people who don't do it are somehow misbehaving.
Protecting their family and loved ones.
That's right. That has some real power. I think peer pressure has some real power. For decades, various kinds of charities have put a lot of effort on trying to get the people who contribute to wear a pin or wear a button or put a decal in their window, so that other people get the feeling as they walk around and see all those pins and buttons and decals that, you know, their neighbors are contributing and they're not doing their share. And that, you know, I mean, that's demonstrated to have a lot of impact. So I think peer pressure works. I think role models work. And I don't see anything dishonorable in saying to people, you know, you ought to prepare for a pandemic. Here's what this rock star did to prepare for a pandemic. She's on the road all the time, and, you know, she doesn't know where she's going to be when the pandemic strikes, and here's what she carries with her on the road, and here's the roadie that carries it for her. I'm making up ads as I go along here, but I have no quarrel with that. But that's only step one. That's to get people started. Facts are not going to get people started, but facts can keep people going.
Right. So just to summarize, as we maybe perhaps segue into the during emergency messaging, it sounds to me like you do see a value, that you do see the potential for impact for preparedness messaging if it's done in maybe a creative, innovative way, which, to be honest, is different from sort of some of the conclusions we were coming to based on previous conversations, where we were really sort of the mind, resources, maybe this is not the best use of funds. Maybe it's more about going out into the communities and really engaging with community leaders and building those relationships and fine-tuning the messages that can be released at the time so that they're, and even having the community provide input on those messages in advance. Maybe that's a better way to focus our energies than on these more general preparedness campaigns. But what I'm hearing from you is, If there is still political pressure to still do these, and in fact, maybe there may be some value to these if they're done in the right way.
Yeah, I don't have an opinion, or at least I don't have a strong opinion on the relative value of preparedness versus just-in-time crisis communication. I see the argument that you're making, and that apparently others have made to you, that, you know, rather than spending our budget, you know, telling people to get ready for X and Y, we ought to get ready to tell people about X and Y when it's about to happen, and when they're already interested and they're already reading in the newspaper that awful things are expected within the next few days, then you don't have to be interesting anymore. They're interested, you know, and saving your time and saving your budget for when people are already upset, so that you can just guide them rather than having to upset them and then guide them. I see the case for that, and I'm willing to look at the data on, you know, how much money we ought to spend beforehand versus how much we ought to save for moments when people are real worried and when the crisis is beginning. But my stronger feeling, I mean, the thing on which I have a feeling is, if you're going to spend money on preparedness campaigns, do good preparedness campaigns. You know,
right.
I mean, you know what the science says and what the data says and what the theory says about what kind of preparedness campaign is likely to work and what kind is not. There's one thing I wanted to add before we move to sort of what you do in, or maybe two things before we move to what you do in the middle of a crisis. One is, you know, I talked earlier about how making people more afraid of the risk is a good way to motivate some behavior, and it is. I wanted to mention that not infrequently the problem isn't insufficient fear of the risk you're worried about. It's excessive opposition to the precaution. I mean, in terms of my hazard versus outrage model, and I use the term outrage to cover fear and worry and concern and anger and sort of all the reasons why people might be upset about something. You know, sometimes people aren't outraged enough about the risk, but other times they're too outraged about the precaution, and those are different audiences. So if you're trying to persuade people to get vaccinated, you've got one audience of people who aren't worried enough about the disease. You've got another audience of people who are too worried about the vaccine, you know, or if you're trying to get workers to use their safety goggles and their hard hats and their, you know, their steel-toed boots, one problem is maybe they're not worried enough about getting hurt on the job. The other problem is they hate the equipment. It's geeky and it's uncomfortable. So it's always an empirical question. To what extent is the best path in increasing the outrage about the hazard, which is, you know, getting them more upset? And to what extent is the best path in decreasing the outrage about the precaution? And I wouldn't want to leave out that possibility because it's always worth asking yourself the question, you know, should I get them more upset about the risk or less upset about the thing I'm urging them to do?
And can it be both, or does it have to be one or the other?
No, I think it can be both, but you're going to have to allocate your resources. So,
right.
I mean, it's going to be one or the other, you know, to varying degrees. It's going to, you know, it's probably not going to be both equally.
Right.
And maybe one for I mean, you know, you may be bifurcating your audience. I mean, you know, with vaccination, it's perfectly clear that the people who are apathetic and about infectious diseases and the people who are terrified of vaccines are different people.
Right.
You know, and you know, you need both messages, but not usually for the same audience.
Right.
The other thing that I wanted to say before we move on to what to do in the middle of a crisis is that one of the downsides of warning people is sometimes you turn out wrong. You know, and you go to people and you say, you know, there's going to be a pandemic and, you know, you ought to do this and you ought to do that and ought to do the other. And then no pandemic happens, as indeed there has not yet been an H5N1 pandemic. And we had several years of pretty aggressive public health warnings that H5N1 looked like it, you know, might go pandemic, and it didn't. And instead, H1N1 went pandemic, and it was very mild. It killed fewer people than the average flu season. And I think public health preparedness lost a lot of credibility as a result of that sequence of events. So, I mean, part of the issue that, you know, that we talked about earlier is how do you get people upset enough to take precautions? But yet always have to ask yourself, you know, how do I get them upset enough to take precautions without undermining, you know, the next 10 times I'm going to want to warn them about something if this one doesn't happen?
Right.
And I think the main solution to that, I mean, there are a bunch of things I would recommend if I had an hour to devote to that alone. But I think the main solution to that is to focus more on risk probability and less on risk magnitude. And the role model here, as far as I'm concerned, is people who sell insurance. You know, and you know, a good insurance salesperson is not going to imply to you that your house is sure to catch fire and you should insure your house against the fire because there's going to be a fire probably next Tuesday. That's not a wise campaign for the insurance industry to do because, there's no fire, and a year goes by, and you're looking at your policy, trying to decide whether to renew it. And if the focus was on the probability of the risk, if the probability of the risk gets overstated, then if the risk doesn't materialize, credibility is lost. So what a good insurance person does is focus much more on how awful it would be if your belongings were to burn. They focus on the magnitude of the risk. Even if this is unlikely, it would disrupt your life so much that there are precautions worth taking. And, maybe you ought to do this and this and this and this to make a fire less likely, or to insure against the fire so that you'll have the money to rebuild if you need to. And those campaigns wisely emphasize the magnitude of the risk and dramatize the magnitude of the risk. And I think we often get that wrong in emergency preparedness warnings. We often sound like we're saying, it's going to happen. Whether you're George Bush saying Saddam has weapons of mass destruction, or your Greenpeace saying global climate change is gonna fry us all, too much insistence that you're sure you're right tends to backfire if the risk doesn't occur on schedule. And more focus on the magnitude of the risk, less on the probability of the risk, is a lot more sustainable, given that preparedness is a gamble. And the one of my favorite preparedness messages is, I hope this investment is wasted.
Right.
People want is that you should prepare for the things that are going to happen and don't waste a lot of money preparing for the things that are not going to happen. I once read two editorials in a London newspaper on the same day. One was during the swine flu pandemic, and one was complaining that London had purchased far too much vaccine against swine flu, and that was a wasted investment. And the other editorial was complaining that they hadn't purchased nearly enough road salt, and it was a bad winter, and they ran out of salt for the roads. And, neither editorial mentioned the other, and neither took into consideration the reality that when you're buying vaccine or road salt, you don't know how bad the pandemic is going to be, and you don't know how much snow you're going to get this winter. But I think the only way to protect against that, or the most useful way to protect against that, is to say flat out, this will be awful if it happens. We're not confident it will happen, but the risk is too high to go unprotected. So we want to do X and Y and Z so that if it happens, we'll be in better shape to cope, and maybe it'll make it less likely. But we want to do these things. And we hope this money is wasted. We hope there isn't any snow this winter, and we're sitting on a lot of wasted salt. We hope the pandemic is mild, and we're sitting on a lot of wasted vaccine. We would much rather waste this precaution than eat it. But God help us if we need it and don't have it.
And just as a point of clarification, coming from New York City, where obviously a big part of our argument, certainly to funders, is, we are sort of at highest risk in the country for terrorism, and we have evidence behind it. So do you think that could hurt us in our arguments or as we message?
No, I think if the risk is higher, if the probability of the risk is higher in New York than it is elsewhere, and it makes sense to me that it would be, I think that's a sound thing to say. I still wouldn't sound like I think, we're on borrowed time. Messages that say we're on borrowed time, we've been lucky so far, but it can't last much longer. There's going to be a successful terrorist attack in the next 2 years. It's not if, but when.
Right.
I think those are messages that backfire. I never like the it's not if, but when message, because it's too vulnerable. If the when doesn't happen soon enough, it looks like you were wrong on the if.
Right.
I think you're on much stronger ground saying, look, it's not damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's damned if you do and darned if you don't. The cost to us if we take the precaution and don't need it is not nothing, but it's tolerable. The cost to us if we need the precaution and haven't taken it is unacceptable.
Right. Okay, should we seg to at the time?
Okay.
So, I mean, the one thing also from basically our very preliminary research, I mean, what we're hearing is, or reading, is how important it is to get community input in advance in terms of having a sense of what the concerns are in advance to help tailor the message so that they're as effective as possible at the time. And, of course, the challenge is each community and each scenario carries different concerns to be considered.
Yeah, it's a never-ending task. I mean, there are two good reasons for seeking community input about what to do during a crisis and how to talk during a crisis. The first one, which is the one you mentioned, is community people really know things we don't know about themselves and about what's going to work and what's not going to work. And, you know, I think about Roz Lasker's research. Have you?
Yep. Yep. We've read that.
You've read that.
And by the way, you know how to track her down. I've been trying to track her down to talk to her, and I haven't been able to find her.
No, I know where she was, but if she isn't where she was, I have no idea where she is.
Okay. Thank you.
But you know, Roz's study and every study that I've ever seen that sat down with people and said, you know, if X and Y happens and we said this to you, how would you react? What people told them was different from what they'd expected. And, you know, you always learn things, you know, sometimes huge things. One of the many lessons of Katrina is people are very reluctant to evacuate if there's no place for their pets. And it just wasn't predicted. Now it's predicted. Now I think everybody who does emergency preparedness knows that if the shelters don't take pets, they're not going to take the people who own pets, but they won't come without their pets. But you didn't have to wait for a disaster to know that. If you asked people, they would have told you.
Right.
So asking people is irreplaceable, absolutely essential. And, yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, theoretically, everybody you ask tells you something you didn't hear from anybody else. And eventually, you got to figure enough is enough. But, you prioritize the populations that are largest and the populations that are most vulnerable and the populations that you suspect are most different from everybody else. Those would seem to me to be the three criteria. I want to get
right.
I want to get the bulk of the people. I want to get the people who are likeliest to be in deep trouble if I don't reach them, and I want to get the people for whom the messaging is probably has to be different because they're atypical in some way. And that helps guide you to who to talk to. But the other reason for seeking input is that the process of giving you input is enormously useful to people in terms of getting them ready. So I would seek more input than I needed because it's just so damn useful to give it to you, even if you already know what people are telling you. Once I have told it to you, granted, you knew it already. You didn't need to hear it. But once I've told it to you, I'm more attentive to it. I'm more interested in the risk. I'm more worried. I'm more likely to take precautions. I'm more likely to take your advice in mid-crisis because we have a prior relationship. And you listened to me then. I'm willing to listen to you now. So there's a lot of payoff in having the public give you counsel other than the counsel itself.
Right. That is definitely a conclusion that we're making.
One of the basic, recommendations in crisis communication, I mean, another way to turn that around is, what do crisis communicators most often get wrong? And it seems to me, that, I mean, there's a long list of things they ought to do, but there's a comparatively short list of things they usually do badly. And at the very top of my list of things that crisis communicators often do badly is they tend to over-reassure. That the core message in a crisis should never, ever be calm down, don't worry about it, it's under control. The situation is under control is always a bad message. Even if the situation is under control, it's a bad message, but it's especially a bad message given that the situation, you know, is usually not under control. If it, you know, that message is, you know, is almost always prematurely given early in a crisis that may eventually come under control. And when it does, you can't say so because you've already claimed it was under control when it wasn't. I think the core point that to be made there is people need help bearing how upset they are. They don't need help becoming less upset. However upsetting the crisis is, you know, that's good because it motivates precaution taking. You know, you want people concerned. You don't want people, you know, shrugging it off and carrying on business as usual. You want them to take the crisis seriously. So that concern is useful, and it's valid. It's justified. So that it isn't useful, and it tends to undermine your credibility to try to tell people not to be upset. If you succeed, so they're not upset and they die apathetic. They don't take precautions, but you don't usually succeed. Usually, messages to calm down don't calm people down. They tend to arouse people's additional concern. I mean, it's terrifying that the people in charge seem to think this is no big deal. I think the thing we most often get wrong, or crisis communicators most often get wrong, is their own fear of the public's fear. Instead of trying to help the public bear it, they try to help the public reduce it.
Right.
So, yes, this is upsetting. Of course this is upsetting. I'm upset, too. We'll get through this together. This is going to be a hard time, but if we hang together, we can, you know, we'll be able to cope. You know, messages of determination and communitarianism, you know, we're going to face this together, much more useful than messages of optimism and calm.
Right. Okay.
Another sort of pretty obvious point, but it's something that often gets mishandled, is the need to avoid overconfidence. I mean, if there's anything that's characteristic of emergencies, it's very high levels of uncertainty. You don't know what's going on. You don't know how bad it's going to get. You don't know what will happen next. Very often, you don't know what you're going to do about it. If you're going to try something, you don't know whether it's going to work and whether you might want to back off of that and try something else. So both messages of uncertainty about what's happening and what will happen, and messages of tentativeness about your plans, I think are extremely useful. I think crisis communicators often sound overconfident, and just as over-reassurance backfires and can make people more alarmed, overconfidence can backfire and make people all the more uncertain because they smell a rat. They sense that you're not confident. But if they don't smell a rat and you succeed in conveying overconfidence, it's not useful. You want people to be resilient. You want them to be flexible. You want them, for, among other things, you want them to accept it if you change your mind about how best to cope. If you're going to say shelter in place and then a few hours later you're going to say evacuate, it helps if you don't, you know, if you don't defend shelter in place, it's obviously the right thing to do. And only an idiot would want to evacuate under these circumstances.
Right. And in terms of, the pre-development of materials so that they're ready to go, because that's something we certainly think a lot about, especially for an incident that happens very quickly and, you know, there's going to be a lot of pressure to get messages out quickly. Do you have any thoughts on how to sort of, you know, what is the most effective sort of messaging tools to have ready? And, you know, to be honest, like at the health department, we focused a lot on frequently asked questions as sort of the main document that we then work off of. But I was just curious what your thoughts are on that.
It depends in large measure on how big an emergency you're talking about. If you're talking about a huge crisis, you know, like a severe pandemic, where you have all the attention you could possibly want and all the media time you could possibly want, that's one kind of of, you know, set of messages you would prepare. It's quite a different set of messages if you're talking about a genuine crisis, but it's relatively confined, and you still, you know, you're still doing a great deal of outreach to people who aren't concerned about it as they ought to be. And you're fighting for airtime, and you're fighting for people's attention. I think it's a mistake to assume that all crises are huge enough that the problem of getting attention is solved. But
right.
Where that's true, frequently asked questions are, I would buy that. But, you know, I mean, if people, I mean, the genre of frequently asked questions by definition implies that you're talking to people who are already worried. You know, people who aren't already worried don't have any questions. You know, that's true in some emergencies and it's not true in others.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep. So just in the interest of time, just wondering if Mark had any questions. I've been sort of dominating the questions.
No, I think, Marissa, I think you've hit on a lot of the good points. And actually, as he was going through, I think Peter gave a lot of good examples of things that I was about to ask about. So I think he's covered some of the things.
Great.
It's been very insightful.
I certainly wouldn't want to imply that in an hour we've covered the waterfront.
I know.
We'd love to talk to you more,
but we're trying to honor your time. I have two last questions. One, if there's anything you feel like you haven't touched on that you feel is important for us to consider, and two, is if there are other people, like good people in this area that you think it would be good for us to talk to.
Well, particularly on the topic we were discussing last, the sort of preparing messages in the can, I would certainly talk to Vince Covello, who, you know, I think has more expertise than anybody else I know about, you know, pre-planning emergency messaging. And I admit to a, you know, while I see real value in that, my own bias is more toward shooting from the hip, you know, toward, you know, getting a sense of, you know, spending an hour under pressure, figuring out what people need to know, what I feel a need to tell them, what they feel a need to know, who I need to reach. And I tend to do my messaging, or a lot of my messaging, last minute. And that's dangerous because you can't test it, or you can't test it properly, and you're not thinking it through. And you know, there's a lot of benefit to pre-preparing your messages. And I would certainly want to talk to Vincent about that because I think he has more expertise there than anyone else.
And pardon my ignorance, is he easy to find? Where is he based?
Yeah, you will not have any trouble finding
okay,
him.
Okay,
but if you do, send me an email and I'll send you contact information.
Great.
Maybe, you know, if Roz has disappeared, maybe Vincent has too, you know. We're all getting old, you know. But I would also, for what it's worth, mention that my website has a lot of written information and some videos specifically on crisis communication and pre-crisis communication. So, you know, insofar as we haven't, it's not just that we haven't covered all there is to be said, but we haven't even covered all the things I like to say.
Right.
So, you know, feel free to make use of the website as well.
Great. Well, we really, really appreciate it. This has been incredibly helpful, and I know your time is valuable, so we just want to thank you so much again.
Well, my pleasure. And when you have a final work product, will I automatically get it, or can you speak to it?
We would love to share it with you, and especially if you wanted to take a look at it, and if you had any comments, that would be great, too. But we could certainly share it with you.
I'd love to see it in draft, and if I have comments, I'd be happy to share them, and I'd
Excellent.
Like to get a finished copy.
Excellent. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.